Thank you, Barbara and Nick, and for your hospitality and for your introduction, and thank you all for coming tonight. Tonight's very special for me because I have my oldest son is here, Rory, who's kind of sitting in the middle. He was here in, I guess, on my second visit. I'm sorry, I made him uncomfortable. He was here on my second visit to Quarry Farm, and that was in 1996. And he was sitting in the back row with his mother, and I think he was a year old at the time and lasted about 5 minutes into my lecture, so I'm sure he'll last longer tonight. He was requested to leave on that occasion by his father. In 1867, as Twain told the story in the San Francisco newspaper, The Alta California, he approached the organizer of the Quaker City expedition to the Holy Land by having a colleague introduce him as Mark Twain, the Reverend Mark Twain, a clergyman of some distinction. This may or may not have really happened. One never knows with Twain, but he said it happened. It was a typical sort of joke, one with a barb to it. The Quaker City expedition was a high-minded one, with a number of gatekeepers to expel riffraff, like Twain. And Twain lamented in The Innocents Abroad that, quote, the character and standing of every applicant for passage had to undergo the strictest assay by a committee. By masquerading, even if only in his writing, as the Reverend Mark Twain, Twain played a practical joke on the committee that, like all such jokes, contains an element of hostility. This is a literary practical joke, however, and not just a personal one. Twain used the cruise to create the occasion for parody and burlesque. The noted author of The Tall Tale, The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, and such hoaxes as The Petrified Man and Bloody Massacre Near Carson would accompany a flock of wealthy, psalm-singing Easterners, ostensibly with the design of assisting the Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, who was truly a clergyman of some distinction. The literary masquerade as the Reverend Mark Twain was part of a pattern, for Twain had embarked on the Quaker City cruise to the Old World and the Holy Land to situate himself as an observer and parodist in that environment of devout attention to the geography of religion. It was what he later labeled health-giving theological travel. Now, what exactly does this phrase health-giving theological travel mean? The expression occupies an ironic place in Twain's work. Twain used the term in Hellfire Hotchkiss, an unfinished 1897 burlesque based on his brother Orion Clemens. In this story, the Orion figure is renamed Oscar. The following discussion concerning Oscar's future takes place in the first chapter. Why do you think him suited for the pulpit? The law is a narrow field, Sarah. In fact, it is merely a groove, or you may call it a house with only one room in it. But in religion, there are 100 sects. It is a hotel. Oscar could move from one room to another room, you know. It is my opinion that he ought to be dedicated to this career of sparkling holiness, usefulness, and health-giving theological travel. Theological travel, then, consists of having uncertain, malleable opinions on religious issues. In Autobiography of a Damned Fool, in 1877, Twain describes the titular fool, clearly again based on his brother, as, quote, soft and sappy, full of fine intentions and shifting religions, and not aware that he is a shining ass. In Schoolhouse Hill, the Orion figure is Mr. Hotchkiss, quote, a diligent and enthusiastic seeker after truth and a sincere believer in the newest belief, but a man who had missed his vocation. He should have been a weather vane. His good Presbyterian wife, in contrast, was as steady as an anvil. She was not a creature of change. In the later work, Which Was It?, 1900-1902, Twain renames the Orion figure Hamfat. The name itself seems a parody of traditional biblical names, suggesting someone who is ever chewing over some indigestible theological integument. Hamfat, we are told, is a, quote, fervent disciple and advocate of every frantic ism that had ever come his way, and had skirmished under the banner of every religion known to history, including Mormonism, infidelity, voodoo, and was now due to be an atheist, the next revolution of his spiritual bowels, as Doug Hapgood said. As a metaphor for accepting the religious beliefs of others, theological travel is, in Twain's presentation of it, not altogether a good thing. How do we reconcile some of these themes in Twain's fictional works with what we might call Twain's own theological travel in the travel book genre? In a surprising number of works, The Innocents Abroad and Following the Equator among them, Twain sets out to explore faraway places with strange-sounding names and even stranger-sounding deities. The writer courts confrontation with different religions or denominations, yet seems frequently conservative, or even from a 19th-century Protestant perspective, orthodox. You know, Mark Twain. Now, I argue in The Reverend Mark Twain, for example, that Twain's reference points are almost always conservative. In this, I agree with Michael Kiskus, who argues against Twain's, quote, supposedly unambiguous support for individual, even iconoclastic freedom, end quote. Consider, for example, the conclusion to The Innocents Abroad. Twain makes this sweeping statement. Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. This is a common assumption, that travel has a broadening effect on people. But Twain makes this statement at the end of Innocents Abroad, and this is a book in which, just a few hundred pages earlier, he described Italy as, quote, a land which has groped in the midnight of priestly superstition for 1,600 years, and who refers to priestcraft. I mean, this is a term he uses, and I mean, it's an inflammatory kind of term. Likewise, confronted with Arab beggars in the Holy Land a few dozen chapters earlier, he had compared them to American Indians, saying they, quote, make a white man so nervous and uncomfortable and savage that he wants to exterminate the whole tribe. Now, doubtless, such statements are part of Twain's persona as the American Vandal. Twain adopts the pose of setting up a radical difference between his own Protestantism and even at times specifically a Presbyterian religious background and the beliefs of those whom he observes. Thus, during the Quaker City excursion, Twain is one of the sinners able to comment freely on the antics of the pilgrims with whom he shares a nationality and a ship, as well as, at the same time, a representative Protestant whose traditional beliefs contrast with what he describes in Rome, Jerusalem, and in all points in between. Now, I suspect that the practice of making a spectacle of religious others emerges directly from Twain's boyhood growing up in Hannibal, Missouri. In the late work, Which Was It?, Twain depicts a small village reminiscent of his childhood Hannibal. Indian Town's Christianity, he notes, was of the usual southern breeds, Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist. Yet there was more variety in Twain's Hannibal than one might suppose from this comment. Mormons passed through Hannibal on their way west. Catholics were settling in the west, a move that some Protestants viewed as an invasion. It's the kind of language that was used. In 1861, Twain himself heartily recommended the book Armageddon, or The Overthrow of Romanism and Monarchy, to his brother Orion. In this book, Samuel Davies Baldwin identified the Catholic Church as the Antichrist and predicted that the Battle of Armageddon would be fought before 1875 in the Mississippi Valley. Either the date or the location or both turned out to be wrong. I'm not sure which. Beyond this Roman Catholic menace, as it was viewed, Hannibal had its traveling phrenologists, palm readers, and a resident free thinker. Folk beliefs were commonly mixed with religion as well, as in the character of Aunt Hannah, an African-American conjure woman Twain writes about in his autobiography. Outside of town, camp meetings and revivals provided entertainment. Twain drew on those memories when writing the camp meeting episode in Huckleberry Finn's chapter 20. This is in Huck's voice, and this is from the original draft. He changed it later in a significant way, but I'm going to read it the way he originally wrote it. The people woke up more and more and sung louder and louder, and towards the end some begun to groan and some begun to shout. The preacher begun to preach, and he warmed up right away and went a-weaving first to one side of his platform and then to the other, and then a-leaning down over the front of it with his arms and his body a-going it all the time and sing-songing his words out with all his might and main, so you could have heard him a mile. And every now and then he'd hold up his open Bible and kind of passing around this way and that, shouting, "It's the brazen serpent in the wilderness! Look upon it and live!" And people would sing out, "Glory! Amen!" and so on. Next, he'd lay the Bible down, and he'd weave about the platform and work to the Bible again, and pretty soon he'd fetch it a whack with his fist and shout, "Here it is, the rock of salvation. The Spirit's a-working in you, brother. Don't shake him off. Now is the accepted time. The devil's hold is a-weakening on you, sister. Shake him loose. Shake him loose. One more shake, and the victory's won." Now, that's the way it's written. That's the original version. It's not the way it's printed in the version today, but he removed the A-H, the aspirations that you hear at the end of those lines, that we're familiar with. And we're familiar with it, I think, because of television, primarily. Now, I have seen this in real life myself and when I lived in Georgia at a revival that was across the street from the county fair, and it was amazing. This is the kind of thing, and I suspect that he removed those aspirations probably because he felt that his audience wouldn't know what they were. I'm guessing. Today we know, because we've seen it, at least on television or in the movies, and maybe sometimes in real life. But in addition to such camp meetings and other events that did happen while Twain was growing up in Hannibal, on at least one occasion, the world did not end. That notable event did not happen on October 22, 1844, when Twain was 9 years old. The religious leader William Miller had identified October 22nd of that year as the date for Christ's return, prompting believers in Hannibal to don their white robes, climb the hill, and wait on the plateau known as Lover's Leap, a spot visible from most parts of the little town. You can drive your car up there today. I mean, it's a wonderful place. I took my family up there a couple of years ago. It's a wonderful place to look at the sunset from. And in all fairness, it would be a good place to view the end of the world from, I think. But more to the point, and I think this is why Twain was so struck by it and why he writes about this, it was a great place to watch those people walk up the hill and then walk back down, embarrassed. And I think this is part of what Twain thinks of when he thinks of the spectacle of others' beliefs as different from his own. Twain takes obvious delight when he describes this event in The Innocents Abroad. He states that the Millerites, quote, "made ready to fly up into heaven at the first blast of the trumpet." He laconically concludes that the angel did not blow it. In Traveling in Mark Twain, Richard Bridgman argues that Twain embraces the travel book precisely because, quote, "one need have neither a coherent worldview nor even a particular end in mind to write a travel book." Now, if you think about this, what this is saying about Twain is that there is a lack of coherence that in the travel book that Twain's incoherent writing methods would work well with. Actually, I feel that that there is a coherent worldview in much of what he's doing, that it is just a conservative one, and that it goes kind of unnoticed in some instances. Twain, who said that human nature cannot be studied in cities except at a disadvantage, a village is the place, had a coherently village point of view. It comes from that experience of looking, of being part of the usual southern breed of church, and anyone who doesn't fit into that mold makes a spectacle of themselves. So frequently with the travel books, this is actually what he's doing. He's going out into other places, other countries, or other parts of this country, and roughing it, for example, and commenting on the spectacle that those other people are making of themselves, in his view. Now, saying that Twain took delight in the spectacle of religious differences, just as he had experienced them in his youth, and just as he has delighted in making a spectacle of his brother Orion's theological wonderings, saying that this is something he does from a typically conservative worldview is really a polite way of saying that Twain laughs at other people's beliefs. Okay. This is particularly true of his earlier work. This illustrates what is perhaps most interesting about Twain's response to other beliefs as he left Hannibal for the American West and then the world. Occasionally, theological travel does consist of sheer fun at another person's expense or another group of people's expense. Frequently, however, Twain's burlesques of what we would call heterodoxy and what he would usually call wildcat religion are critical both of religious wildcats and of mainstream Protestantism. The term wildcat is one that Twain acquired from Western mining. It refers to a speculative mine located away from the mother vein. Metaphorically, wildcat religions, as Twain terms them, deviate from mainstream religion. For Twain, they include anything outside of the usual southern breeds of church, as he called it. When he went west, Twain contrasted his own Presbyterianism to the wildcat religion of spiritualism in an article called The New Wildcat Religion. I do not take any credit to my better balanced head because I never went crazy on Presbyterianism. We go too slow for that. You never see us ranting and shouting and tearing up the ground. You never heard of a Presbyterian going crazy on religion. No frenzy, no fanaticism, no skirmishing, everything perfectly serene. You never see any of us Presbyterians getting in a sweat about religion and trying to massacre the neighbors. Let us all be content with the tried and safe old regular religions and take no chances on wildcat. Now, this is a good example of Twain's practice of theological travel. Going west, he comes across this new wildcat religion of spiritualism. He burlesques it, makes fun of it, but he also uses the occasion to poke fun at his own background and at society in general. Reading his sketch, we chuckle at the foolishness, at the spectacle these Orion figures are making of themselves over spiritualism. Twain asserts that it is a good thing not to massacre the neighbors, and we all have to agree. Right? I'm making assumptions, but make sure before I proceed. At the same time, Twain depicts Presbyterianism as a bit too serene, as the frozen chosen Presbyterians are sometimes called, sometimes by our Baptist friends. The tried and safe old regular religions have much to recommend them, but translate Twain's words, old, boring, uninspiring. Twain describes Presbyterian services this way. Notice us and you will see how we do. We get up of a Sunday morning and put on the best harness we've got and trip cheerfully downtown. We subside into solemnity and enter the church. We stand up and duck our heads and bear down on a hymn book propped up on the pew in front when the minister prays. We stand up again while our hired choir are singing and look into the hymn book and check off the verses to see that they don't shirk any of the stanzas. We sit silent and grave while the minister is preaching and count the waterfalls and bonnets furtively and catch flies. We grab our hats and bonnets when the benediction is begun. When it's finished, we shove, so to speak. I mean, it really is funny, and it's, I'm a Presbyterian, and it's kind of like this, and I have to admit that I think of this description sometimes when the benediction is being said, and when my preacher is saying, Even as the pastor is telling us to go out into the world in peace and giving the benediction, I am surreptitiously slipping my hymn book in the right pew in front of me so I can shove, you know, so to speak, and get out quickly. So here, Twain's criticism cuts both ways. Wildcat religions are dangerous, but shouldn't there be something more in choosing a religion than searching for something tried, safe, and regular? Twain jokes about other religions then, but also comments on more traditional forms of worship and belief. Jeffrey Melton, in Mark Twain, Travel Books and Tourism, notes that Twain consciously endorsed the, quote, righteousness of his readers, white, Protestant, democratic society, even while undermining conventional perceptions to nudge his readers' assumptions under the veil of laughter. Like the Quaker City excursion, Twain's Western theological travels brought him into constant contact with a variety of religious practices, like spiritualism, but also Buddhism, for example. During his years in San Francisco, Twain wrote a number of burlesques of Oriental religions, and his several pieces about the Chinese temple built by the Ningyang Company are good examples of his response. The first of these, written in August 19, 1864, The New Chinese Temple, introduces the Josh House, or place of worship, built by the Chinese for their unchristian devotions. Twain's description of the statue of Josh is both a somewhat realistic depiction and a xenophobic rejection of the formal aspects of this worship. Forever after lavishing much attention onto the details of gold leaf and the glaring red face, Twain concludes that, quote, the general expression of this fat and happy god is as if he had eaten too much rice and rats for dinner and would like his belt loosened if only he had the energy to do it. Travel has that broadening influence here. We talked about here. Twain put the Chinese temple to more sophisticated parodic use in his next installment, The Chinese Temple, using the figure of Josh to comment on his own Calvinist god and the concept of predestination. The Presbyterian document, the Westminster Confession of Faith, defines predestination this way, quote, by the decree of God, for the manifestation of his glory, some men and angels are predestinated unto everlasting life, and others foreordained to everlasting death, end quote. Now one can hear in the background Huckleberry Finn's mangling of this definition when he discusses pre or fore or destination, and I don't know what all, but it was one of the roughest Sundays I'd run across yet. Remember that? In the sketch about the Chinese temple, Twain explains that this old original Josh can bless Chinamen or damn them according to the best of his judgment. Twain ends the passage by subjecting his own denomination to the treatment. As far as we are concerned, we don't believe it, for it all sounds so plausible. Too familiar to be very comfortable, this idea of predestination. Twain uses the exotic figure of Josh, his twisting of the proper term Joss, to refer to the Western Josh or joke, to burlesque the Calvinist god so familiar to his contemporaries. He casts traditional Christian doctrines into a view dominated by a rat-eating god whose celebrations include the beating of drums, the clanging of gongs, and the burning of yellow paper. Twain's depictions of these religious practices recall his comments on Mormon worship that includes, quote, horns and cymbals and trumpets and all the ungodly paraphernalia of their choir service, end quote. Twain's suggestions that these other beliefs are deviant, different, or other are obviously irreverent and frequently unfair, but such burlesques typically comment on Christianity, Protestantism, or even more specifically the church he was raised in, Presbyterianism. Thus, the theological travel in these instances, at least, might be broadening, as Twain suggests it is, without leaving one a shining ass like his brother Orion. So there is a possibility in theological travel of at least appreciating other groups of people, their beliefs, and using those beliefs to criticize one's own faith, and that this would have a broadening influence. Creating such a spectacle of the religious beliefs of others does make people uncomfortable, but not always in predictable ways. Generally, I think people do enjoy making light of other religious beliefs, but it's not always the case. On a couple of occasions, I have been invited to teach the Sunday school class at my church on Sunday evenings to talk about Mark Twain and Presbyterianism. It's a Presbyterian church. And so you would think that my fellow Presbyterians would really laugh at Twain's depictions of other systems of belief. But in fact, I was, much to my surprise, that was not the case. They were very disinclined to laugh at Catholicism and Buddhism and Mormonism and Christian Science. But when I got to his comments on Presbyterianism, it was hilarious. They thought it was the funniest thing in the world. It was almost as funny to them as Twain's comments about the Baptists. That's, you know, in Waco, Texas, I mean, I teach at Baylor University, and, you know, we're proud of the fact that we're the largest Baptist university in the world, chartered by the Republic of Texas, not the state, but the Republic. And so we like to make fun of our Baptist friends, but not so much that we get fired. Now, I think that this illustrates the reaction that people have to the reaction that y'all are having here, really, toward Twain's comments. I think does illustrate this broadening influence that Twain claims for theological travel. And it has to do, I think, with Twain's practice of inciting laughter at the expense of others and then directing it back at us. In his essay, Reflections on the Sabbath, from 1866, Twain notes his own rank of brevet Presbyterian, which affords one the right to be punished as a Presbyterian hereafter. That is, the substantial Presbyterian punishment of fire and brimstone instead of this heterodox hell of remorse of conscience of these blamed wildcat religions. The heaven and hell of the wildcat religions are vague and ill-defined, but there's nothing mixed about the Presbyterian heaven and hell. The Presbyterian hell is all misery. The heaven, all happiness. Nothing to do. But when a man dies on a wildcat basis, he will never rightly know hereafter which department he is in. Now, Twain criticizes nebulous wildcat religions, true, but how much comfort can one take in this substantial Presbyterian punishment of fire and brimstone that we're entitled to? Once again, Twain gets his readers to join with him in poking fun at another faith, only to pull the rug out from under them and make them look at least one traditional variant of Protestantism. This early passage from the San Francisco years resembles Twain's comment decades later in Christian Science. When I was on my way back to Vienna from the Appetite Cure in the Mountains, Twain begins, I fell over a cliff in the twilight and broke some arms and legs and one thing or another. Fortunately, Twain is tended to by a Christian Science doctor from Boston. From this point on, Twain subjects Christian Science and its founder, Mary Baker Eddy, to burlesque. He critiques in particular her revisions of the Ten Commandments and the Lord's Prayer. And yet, once again, Twain comments on his own denomination as well. Here we're discussing the subject of infant damnation. At the same time, Twain writes, I do feel that the shrinkage in our spiritual assets is getting serious. First the commandments, now the Lord's Prayer. I never expected to see these steady, old, reliable securities watered down to this. And this is not the whole of it. Last summer, the Presbyterians extended the calling and election suffrage to nearly everybody entitled to salvation. They did not even stop there, but they let out all the unbaptized American infants we had been accumulating for 200 years and more. There are some that believe they would have let the Scotch ones out, too, if they could have done it. Everything is going to ruin. In no long time, we shall have nothing left but the love of God. Who wants that? Right? Now, you notice what Twain has done. In the midst of burlesquing Christian Science, he comments very specifically on a fairly narrow theological issue in his own denomination. The Westminster Confession of Faith, quoted earlier, implied that unbaptized infants would go to hell. Kenneth Ross, a historian at the Presbyterian Historical Society, once told me that this was, quote, the abortion debate of the 19th century. I mean, this was a major issue for polemics between the different denominations. The Presbyterian synods debated the issue repeatedly and voted on the question for decades before adding a declaratory statement to the confession in 1904. By that time, Twain had written on the subject many, many times, frequently in contexts where he was ostensibly burlesquing another belief system, only to return to commentary on his own, poking fun at his own denomination for believing that a vote in the synod could actually change God's behavior and would actually affect who is in heaven or who is in hell. Another such a moment arises in Following the Equator, 1897. Twain begins chapter 53 with these wonderful showstopper sentences. It was in Benares that I saw another living God. That makes two. Now, the person Twain describes is a Hindu holy man whose short name is Sri 108 Swami Bhaskanarandanda Saraswati. Twain pokes a good deal of fun at the longer name, which covers nearly two lines of text in the published edition of Following the Equator, transcribing it carefully and, from what I can tell, accurately. Twain helpfully informs his readers, you do not put Esquire after it. Twain discusses Hindu beliefs in reincarnation and nirvana and the danger besetting those who labor under a cycle of reincarnation. They risk, he says, dying on the wrong side of the Ganges sometime or other and waking up in the form of an ass. In contrast, Twain writes, when Sri 108 dies, nirvana is his. He will be absorbed into the substance of the supreme deity and be at peace forever. Twain uses the occasion to create a good deal of comedy, even describing how he gave this Swami, who had, quote, attained to what among the Hindus is called the state of perfection, a copy of Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. So Twain gives the Swami a copy of Huckleberry Finn, saying, because the man had achieved perfection, if my book didn't do him any good, it wouldn't do him any harm. And by the way, I feel the same way about my book over on the table over there. It won't hurt anyone. Might not do you any good, though. Now, you get the joke that Twain makes. He suggests that reading Adventures of Huckleberry Finn would help us all achieve enlightenment without painful years of meditating. I tell that to my students, too, but they don't believe me either. Now, after a good deal of such tomfoolery and really doing what we discussed first tonight, making fun of other people's beliefs, laughing at them, not with them. But after a good deal of this, Twain states, somewhat surprisingly maybe at this point in the text, that the man has my reverence. But the reverence which is difficult and which has personal merit in it is the respect which you pay without compulsion to the political or religious attitude of a man whose beliefs are not yours. You can't revere his God or his politics, and no one expects you to do that. But you could respect his beliefs in them if you tried hard enough. And you could respect him, too, if you tried hard enough. But it is very, very difficult. It is next to impossible, and so we hardly ever try. If the man doesn't believe as we do, we say he's a crank, and that settles it. I mean, it does nowadays, because now we can't burn him. Now, Twain's criticism of religious intolerance leads him to refer back to the Inquisition. And his plea for reverence for this holy man without accepting the man's system of belief is really a call for tolerance. And this is what leads him to refer back to the Inquisition. Twain argues for attaining not the living God's state of perfection, but at the very least something approaching tolerance. Elsewhere, and following the equator, Twain gives an example of this when discussing New South Wales and its religious diversity. Quote, "These varieties of religion make a remarkable show. About 64 roads to the other world. You see how healthy the religious atmosphere is. Anything can grow in it." Now, his comment is funny, and it is telling that he calls this diverse religious environment a remarkable show, for I think he does find it highly entertaining. He actually lists the official names of all the churches in New South Wales. However, Twain's statement emphasizes again that certainty in our religious beliefs can be dangerous. He reminds us that it was just this sort of certainty that once led our ancestors to burn those we disagreed with theologically. As Twain says in Man's Place in the Animal World, which was published just a year before Following the Equator, "Man is the only animal that loves his neighbor as himself and cuts his throat if his theology isn't straight." Certainty needs to be tempered with tolerance, and perhaps even with the God's love he mentions in Christian Science. That might be all that is left when two religions collide, but it might be enough. It might be all that keeps the Presbyterians from getting in a sweat about religion and trying to massacre the neighbors. And it was actually here at Quarry Farm that Twain found out that Presbyterians sometimes actually did rise up and massacre their neighbors. He believed that they didn't and was sad to find out that they did when borrowing books off the shelf here at Quarry Farm and reading Macaulay's history and Leckie's histories and discovering what happened in Scotland, for example. And that had a tremendous influence on the development of Connecticut Yankee and many other works and Twain's thinking generally. Twain continues his thought. "We are always canting about people's irreverence, always charging this offense upon somebody or other, and thereby intimating that we are better than that person and do not commit that offense ourselves." You can understand why Twain would be a little sensitive to the issue of being accused of irreverence. For many decades, he had been accused of irreverence. But what he is talking about is the idea that when we simply disparage someone else's beliefs, that that itself is irreverence. When we call him a crank, for example, as he referred to earlier, that that itself is a form of irreverence. And he goes on to say, deep down in our hearts, we are all irreverent. Twain certainly was. Like his contemporaries, and like most of us here tonight, I suspect, Twain heartily enjoyed being irreverent toward others' beliefs. Unlike some people, however, Twain also believed in the broadening value of irreverence toward our own religious systems. Irreverence is a form of love, honor, and charity. It saves us from hypocrisy. It protects us from becoming either dogmatically attached to our own beliefs at the expense of others, even while protecting us from becoming, like Orion, a fervent disciple and advocate of every frantic ism that had ever come his way. And that, I think, is the point of Twain's health-giving theological travel at its best, being true to one's theological background, appreciative of others' theological beliefs, and irreverent toward both. Thank you. Do you have any questions? We have some time. We could be glad to dance around any questions you may have. Yes?
When he was taking this trip to the Holy Land, was he found out that he wasn't the Reverend?
Oh, yeah, he was found out. In fact, he was publishing the letters along the way. And, you know, I can't remember exactly how some of his fellow pilgrims read some of those letters, like where they acquired them. But Yeah, they found out about it. And
it's a miracle they didn't throw him overboard.
There was a little friction, I mean, near the end of the cruise and after the cruise when, you know, some of them picked up on some of the things he had said. Yeah, and really, you know, Twain makes some statements that are really astonishing. For example, the one that I started with where he says that, you know, travel has a broadening influence, and this is, you know, close on the heels of having made some of the statements that seem really narrow-minded. He also made some very thinly veiled references to some of his fellow passengers, you know, where it was so it was easy to see who the people were, and then, you know, went on to defend himself by saying, well, they're just, you know, being thin-skinned, you know, and I said nothing that, you know, should have offended anyone. Yes, other questions? Yes.
What was the brother's religion, or religions?
Well, yes. Orion was a person who, like Twain, really started out in the Presbyterian Church. And I don't know where he ended up. He was excommunicated from the Presbyterian Church. We don't think of that as happening, I guess, in Protestant churches, even in the 19th century, but it actually did. There were trials for heresy in the Presbyterian Church. Twain followed some of these, for example, very closely. There were examples where candidates for the ministry who had gone through seminary, when they were inspected by the preachers and professors, they were found to be wanting on theological issues, and then they'd have trials to decide whether or not they can be ordained or not, and this made the news. I mean, it wasn't on, there was no CNN, you know, but it did make, at least in a couple of cases, it got beyond the Presbyterian Observer, let's put it that way. But Orion was excommunicated from, I think it was the Keokuk, Iowa Presbyterian Church. He had rented a lecture hall, and this is kind of typical of his behavior. Some of us disagree quietly, you know, with some of our church's doctrine, but Orion was not one of these kind of people. He had to disagree very publicly, and so he actually went to the expense of renting a hall and lecturing on some of his disagreements with Presbyterian doctrine, Calvinist doctrine, and that led to his excommunication. So as to where he ended up, I don't know. I doubt that he became a practitioner of voodoo, as Twain said, however. Yes, other questions? Yes. It's really, it's a very complicated question. And the term conservative, yeah, is one that I'm not using in terms of, you know, contemporary politics or anything of that nature. But conservative in the sense of really his point of reference, really, I would argue, and in fairness, I have to say that plenty of my Twain scholar colleagues would disagree with me on this, but there are a few who would agree, I think. I think really from beginning to end, Twain's point of reference is always what we would call quote-unquote orthodoxy. Now, admittedly, that's always from a particular perspective, because Twain views anything outside of at least the Protestantism of those usual southern breeds, anything outside of that is really a kind of a wildcat for him. And I think they really remain so throughout his life, that his point of reference is always that point of origin. That's where it starts and that's where it ends in that sense. But you are absolutely right that there is a development I would say, a broadening in how he treats other beliefs, other systems, other denominations, other religions. And we see this with these two examples, like The Innocents Abroad and Following the Equator. Both of these books are very interesting in that they are travel books, but they are really, every nationality has its national religion, it seems. And so there is this sense that he is, to use the metaphor he talks about, you know, the hotel room of religion. You know, he's checking out of one and looking into the other and, you know, going around and around, but he always goes back to the same one, you know, where he started. And his comments are usually from this, again, kind of quote-unquote orthodox position. The reason when I use the word orthodox, I'm a little uncomfortable using it because every denomination has its orthodox position. And, you know, what Twain thought of as orthodox was not orthodox from, you know, the Baptist church, from the Catholic church, and so forth. But there is a development in how he views other religions and really how he uses them in his writing. And it is, I think it is more respectful, mostly, as he gets older. It becomes complex, however, with he will make, on some occasions, for example, he'll make kind of positive comments about Roman Catholicism. And this will lead some Twain scholars to say, well, you know, Twain was kind of warming up to Catholicism. He's not the same Twain he was, you know, 30 years before. But, you know, at the same time, you have Twain writing in his notebook, you know, around the turn of the century, things like, you know, now I'm paraphrasing, but what was it? Expel the Mormons and keep the Catholics? ? Or the Christian Scientists are more dangerous than the Catholics. Well, I mean, that's hardly, I mean, it's not a very nice thing to say about either of them, but, you know, even as late as the turn of the century, Twain was, he really viewed Catholicism, the Roman Catholic Church always kind of remained for him a kind of bête noire, something that he feared and responded to in that way. Christian Scientists, the Christian Scientism, he felt like was, he wrote that we will see in this country a despotism the likes we have not seen since the palmy days of the Inquisition because of Christian Science Church. So there, you know, there does remain this kind of attitude that is dismissive, but I think more often than not, and at its best, there is this development where he sees some value in it, even has reverence for people who serve their belief system as best as they can. So we find, for example, Twain writing in Francis Parkman's works about the Jesuits in Canada, you know, Twain writing in the marginal, in the margins of the book, writing about the magnificence of the belief of these men who could withstand the torture, and he really views them as saints, not in the way some of them were sainted, but views them as saints as the way a Protestant would, perhaps. He viewed them as being very strong in their faith, and he respected them. He had reverence for them in the way that he had reverence for the Swami. And so I think that is a powerful kind of development too. What other, any other questions or comments? Yes?
Do you have any dealing with Islam?
You know, not much that I am aware of other than the few comments in The Innocents Abroad. There may be more, but the few comments I've read in The Innocents Abroad, and they're not good. I mean, they're really about as ugly as it gets with some of his comments. He made the comment, for example, that where he said, and I quoted this, where he said that viewing them fills a white man with a desire to kill them, the way a white man wants to kill Indians. So, I mean, that's a pretty rough kind of statement. And I paraphrased it. I can't remember it exactly, but, you know, there he's offending at least two groups of people. And some of his other comments about the idea of the romance of the desert and the idea of the reverence with which the Arab holds his steed, his horse. And he says it's absolutely not true. And his descriptions of them really, it reminds me of his descriptions of American Indians, which again, they're just ugly. They're what they are. You can't sugarcoat them. So it was not an enlightened view, no. Yes?
I have a question about his relationship to the Presbyterian Church here in the Elmira area. I connect him more with Park Church.
Yes, that's true. And I don't know if it was maybe the family connection. Twain's funeral, I think, was it at Park Church and then at Brick Presbyterian Church in New York City, but he was buried here, I believe. But I don't know how to account for that. He did like Thomas K. Beecher. I mean, he was a big fan of Beecher, and he, as probably you all know, he leapt to his defense when Beecher was accused of being too popular a preacher. When Beecher had rented out a lecture hall or some kind of building to preach in, because he was drawing such huge crowds. But Twain defended him in the Buffalo Express. And I think that's an example of how Twain, his religious outlook was kind of broadened by the family he married into to some degree. I mean, I've been over in the Park Church, and one of the things that surprised me, I'm a deacon in the Presbyterian Church, and we don't have a pool table where we meet. Is it still there? Okay, now I've been in Catholic churches where they have, you know, a bowling alley in the basement in Ohio. You know, the small bowling alleys, not the big ones. But it says something about the influence of the family he married into, and I think that's important. And I don't know, you know, if Twain's Presbyterianism, all I can say is that he clung to it. I mean, he refers to it time and again throughout his life in ways, and he's up with the Presbyterian news. I mean, I don't know what the circulation of some of the little Presbyterian newspapers was, but Twain read them, you know, like the Presbyterian Observer, for example, and followed the debates, so much so that sometimes scholars look at these issues and they just wonder, what in the world was Twain thinking? I remember, I mean, there's a very influential book called The Darkened Sky, and the author's name is escaping me right now. But The Darkened Sky, the author, Trachtenberg, I think, maybe. But anyway, he comments on Twain's interest in Presbyterianism and Calvinism, and says, you know, Twain was talking about infant damnation in 1904, a century after everyone in the country had laid the issue to rest, you know. And, it simply wasn't true. That debate, you know, was a very serious debate. It was one that divided families, and it was one that Twain followed very closely. And today, we may think that that is just really weird, but maybe it requires that act of generosity and tolerance of the views of a previous age to even consider that this might have been an important issue. But I can tell you, it's an issue that is still discussed today. We get the Presbyterian magazine, and it There was someone wrote in a letter to the editor a few months back that asked about the, you know, infant damnation, and you know, they went back to this whole debate Twain was so concerned about. So it's something, you know, I don't know exactly why it remained for him something that stayed with him his whole life, but it really did, even when commenting on, you know, free thinking and, you know, Darwinism and Hinduism, all these other element things going on.
Didn't he get his roots from his parents?
Oh, yes, he did, yes. And so, I mean, he was brought up in the Presbyterian Church, and he, you know, he learned the catechism, you know, what is the chief end of man? To glorify God and enjoy Him forever. I mean, you get the question, you get the answer. They, you know, they follow one right after the next. And that, you know, when Twain writes the revised catechism in the 1870s, you know, the first part of it is, what is the chief end of man? The answer is to get rich. You know, and he's commenting on, you know, American society. He's commenting on Tammany Hall and all of these things going on. And but he does it to do it. He goes back to what he learned, what he memorized. You know, so I mean, it's very interesting. But it's something that, in a lot of cases, I think scholarship has just had a kind of a tin ear to some of these theological debates of this of the 19th century, because they're not here today. So. Well, see, I don't know, and that's actually, I mean, in my book, that's a question I specifically say I'm not going to deal with, because, I mean, I'll deal with your question, but I'm not going to deal with it in the sense that really it's unanswerable, and I think it makes sense to me that it's unanswerable, and I'm glad that it is. In other words, I told you tonight that I'm a deacon in my Presbyterian church in Waco. But, you know, you can assume that is true. You can call him up and ask. But you don't know if I'm a believer. You don't know what the state of my soul is. I don't know what the state of your soul is. And I'm glad. I mean, really. And I'm not saying that I'd be horrified at what I would discover. But I think that that's something that Twain was really, he felt strongly about, was this idea, a very Calvinist concept, of the sovereignty of God. But the corollary to that is the weakness of individual humans. And there is this a respect for the sanctity of the human soul.
Olivia commented someplace along the line that she lost some of her belief.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. I don't know. I deal mainly with his, and I don't, frankly, I don't know if he went. Although I know in the West he did occasionally go to a Presbyterian church when he was in the West, but, you know, after that I don't know. But what I guess what I look at is really the texts, you know, the works where he writes about Presbyterianism, Calvinism, or really religion generally, you know, and it's something that he really wrestles with his whole life. Now, whether he wrestles with belief or disbelief, you know, I don't know, but he certainly writes about theology his entire life. Yes. Well, I mean, it's common. The common view is that Twain's later years were years that were darker, and they certainly were. I mean, we can look at the facts of his biography and see that, you know, he outlived all his children except for one. You know, he outlived his wife. But I would argue that the primary assumptions that Twain makes and what he does with his literature, what he writes about in his essays, that it really it remains the same, that it really doesn't change. And I think that I think from my point of view, the idea of the despairing Twain of the later years has been exaggerated. We are humans, and bad things happen to all of us, you know, and the idea that Twain would suffer from the deaths of family members and that this would be reflected in his work is hardly surprising given his age. I mean, it's inevitable for everyone. And so I think sometimes Hamlin Hill, for example, who was a wonderful man, a great Twain scholar, and was a professor at Texas A&M, not too far from Baylor, was one of the scholars who really talked about this idea of the of Twain as the kind of the dark Twain of the later years. I mean, he wrote Mark Twain, God's Fool, where he kind of explores this thesis. And Hamlin Hill forgave me for disagreeing with him in print. But I think that Twain's, looking at some of the works that Twain wrote, I mean, even The Refuge of the Derelicts, which is an unfinished piece, where Twain, you know, has all of these people who, all these characters who have kind of suffered a number of tragedies or they're incomplete and so forth. There are moments in that work which are just absolutely hopeful and positive. But also, maybe more importantly, they are absolutely in keeping with what he wrote and how he wrote in the earlier years. And even, I think, you know, 3,000 Years Among the Microbes, you know, where the narrator, it's his second narrator named Huck, but this one is a cholera germ. And I think it's quite a humorous work, and it's really, I don't see it as being all that different from the earlier stuff. There's plenty of darkness in some of the earlier stuff, you know, that would match some of the later material as well. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much. I mean, I've really enjoyed talking with you. Enjoy the questions and comments, too.